aboard the Anakin Solo, inside the missile hold.
It was not the dark silence of the missile hold that Alima found so troubling, nor even all those cylinders packed with detonite and beradium and propellant. It was the cold. The caves of Ryloth, where she had spent the first years of her life, had been hot and dry and dusty, and the Gorog nest in which she had lived as a Killik joiner had been warm and humid and close. But the missile hold of the Anakin Solo was frigid. Even with a pair of bulky GAG utilities pulled over her own customary robes, her nose was numb. Her leku were tingling, her teeth chattering, her old wounds aching, and her breath rose in curtains of steam.
Alima, if you don't keep that glow rod on the cut, we're both going to be sorry.
Lumaya was kneeling in front of a missile rack, using her cybernetic hand to carefully run a fusion cutter down the nose cone welds of a beradium missile.
This isn't something I do every day.
You're not making us confident.
Alima shined the light on the missile just ahead of the fusion cutter's beam.
Why not tell Jason to have a trained technician remove the... whatever it is you're after?
The proton detonator charge,
Lumaya said.
And Jason can't know about this.
We should have guessed. But we have told you, Jason is important to the balance. We need him alive.
Lumaya continued to work, moving down the side of the missile toward the point of the initial cut.
I'm doing this to help Jason, not hurt him.
How?
Jason asked me to rendezvous with Ben at Roku Depot,
Lumaya said.
He's about to lead a task force to capture one of the coup leaders at the Relevon Moons, and he wants me to make certain Ben rejoins the Anakin Solo safely.
Alima frowned.
But Ben is aboard a reconnaissance skiff, she said. They can find their way to the Relevon Moons. It sounds suspicious.
Lumaya sighed in exasperation.
It sounds suspicious because it is suspicious. Jason came to me as soon as the Skywalkers ended their little visit. I fear I've become a liability.
You think Jason is sending you into a trap?
I know he is. He's arranging a fight between me and Luke. If I kill Luke, it creates an opening for Jason to take over leadership of the Jedi Order. If Luke kills me, then it looks as though I've been stalking Ben all along. Luke will assume that his original fears were correct, and the veil of suspicion will be lifted off Jason.
What about Jason's destiny?
Alima asked.
Without you to guide him?
Jason has knowledge to complete his journey. All that remains for him is to make his sacrifice.
Then he hasn't?
Not yet, but he will.
We are not sure we like this plan,
Alima said.
If you are killed, his uncle will try to draw Jason back to the light side of the Force.
He won't be able to,
Lumaya said.
Because whether or not I return from this fight, Luke won't.
That is what the proton detonator is for?
Alima asked, finally comprehending Lumaya's plan.
A combat failsafe?
Lumaya nodded.
As you said, I might be killed.
Lumaya removed the proton charge from the missile, then pulled a black combat vest from her tool satchel and slipped the device into a chest pocket.
Very clever,
Alima said.
You win even if you lose.
It is the Sith way.
Lumaya scooted her tool satchel down the floor to the next missile on the rack.
Bring the light. We're running out of time.
We don't understand.
Alima began to have a sinking feeling, but she did as Lumaya asked and shined the light on the nose cone of the missile.
How are you going to wear two proton charges?
I'm not.
Lumaya reignited the fusion cutter, then looked up at Alima.
This one is for you.
Terrafarm.
Ribbons of smoke were still seeping from the hangar mouth and rising into the downpour, but the rest of Villa Solis had obviously burned out long before the rains came. A couple of proton bombs had reduced the site to a smear of rubble and melted stone, leaving only a few ghostly foundation circles to mark where the habitation domes had once stood. To Ben's surprise, he felt only a hint of death in the Force. Either the attack had occurred a very long time ago, which seemed unlikely given the fumes still rising from the hangar, or very few people had died in it. The lilting voice of the skiff's pilot and commander, a Duros junior lieutenant named Beta Ioli, came over Ben's headset, which he and the rest of the crew were wearing to muffle the roar of the oversized engines.
"Something bad happened here. Chief, you picking up anything?"
"Negative, ma'am,"
Tanogo replied. A Bith chief petty officer who had been in the Space Navy since before Ben was born sat 3 meters back in the rover's cramped cabin, operating the Snoop Station, used to locate and evaluate enemy targets.
"There aren't any signals originating within 300 kilometers, but we do have a bogey squadron headed our way from Wero Field."
"My tills?"
Ioli asked.
"Negative. Looks more like headhunters."
"Headhunters?"
Ioli grunted.
"You're kidding."
"The planetary militia still uses headhunters," Ben said. "They're probably curious about us."
"Nobody sends 12 fighters on a look and report,"
Tanogo repeated.
"That's an attack squadron."
"Can't blame them for being cautious. Somebody did just lever their Duchess Palace. Identify us and see if they know what happened."
After the rover had descended to an altitude of 200 meters, Ioli circled around to the front of the ruins, where a cluster of flooded craters sat in what had once been the villa's foreyard. Ben suddenly experienced a sensation of frustration, so faint and muted that he thought at first he might be imagining it.
"They were here," he said.
"Who?"
Tanogo demanded over the headset.
"Be precise, son."
"Sorry," Ben said. "Jaina and Zek. Those craters were a big problem for them."
"I'll say."
Tanogo's voice was sarcastic.
"Getting blasted back to your molecules is always a big problem."
"Chief."
Ioli brought the skiff's nose up and wheeled around to land.
"That's his cousin you're talking about."
"It's okay. Death isn't what I'm sensing," Ben said.
As they swung back toward the villa ruins, the feeling of frustration and anger began to grow weaker.
"Turn back to our old heading, Lieutenant. I think that's the way we need to go."
Ioli started to swing the skiff back around. Ben closed his eyes and pictured Jaina's face, at the same time focusing his attention on the frustration he felt in the Force. The ripples grew stronger, almost instantly, striking him more noticeably from a direction about 20 degrees to their starboard. Without opening his eyes, he pointed.
"That way."
Ioli hesitated for only an instant before swinging the craft in the direction he indicated. Ben extended his Force awareness as far as he could in that direction, picturing Jaina in his mind and trying to touch her through the Force. Then, suddenly, she was there in his mind with him, full of surprise and joy and relief and urgency. Something was terribly wrong, and she needed Ben to help her correct it.
"They're straight ahead."
Ben tried to open his eyes, maybe he did, but Jaina would not release her grip on his mind. All he could see in front of him was her face, looking at once happy and worried and exhausted.
"I think they might be in trouble."
"When you say straight ahead..."
"I mean straight ahead."
Ben extended his arm toward the image of Jaina in his mind.
"There."
The skiff banked hard.
"I said straight."
"I see them,"
Ioli snapped back.
"But I'm not flying into a hillside, no matter who orders me to."
Jaina's image vanished, and a pair of tiny colored blades appeared in the rain, at about the same altitude as the rover. They were some 50 meters ahead, on Ben's side of the canopy, and slowly sliding starboard as Ioli turned away. Through the heavy weather, it was impossible to see the figures holding the blades, but Ben could feel Jaina's concern as the skiff continued its turn. He reached out to her in the Force, trying to reassure her that her lightsaber beacon had been noticed, and then the blades passed out of sight. Ioli's voice came over the headsets.
"Tanogo, How long before those bandits?
We've been flying toward him, Lieutenant,
Tanoga reported.
The interceptors will be in missile range in 2 minutes, and they'll be on top of us in 5.
Then we're in trouble,
Ioli said. No, we're not. Ben unbuckled his crash webbing and stood. They're Jedi. Just get us within 10 meters.
Ioli brought the skiff around so hard that Ben had to force-stick himself to the deck to keep from being flung into the fuselage. She decelerated hard and began to creep forward on the repulsor drives, at the same time issuing engagement orders to their weapons tech. By the time Ben reached the rear airlock and opened the outer hatch, Ioli had the skiff hovering alongside the hill. For a moment, nothing was visible outside but rain, fog, and mounds of mud and grass. Then, one of the mounds suddenly flew off the hillside and landed inside the airlock, spraying tear-shaped mud drops across the viewport of the inner hatch. A moment later, the rover rocked noticeably as a second, heavier weight landed inside.
They're in, Ben reported. But take it easy. They haven't had time to...
Missile range,
Tanoga reported.
Launch!
The skiff tipped its nose up and shot skyward so fast that Ben had to catch a grab handle to keep from tumbling back into the Twi'lek weapons tech. A pair of dull thumps reverberated from inside the airlock, and for a moment, he thought Ioli might have lost Jayn Arzak. A moment later, the inner hatch slid open, and the two Jedi stepped into the flight cabin, sagging in exhaustion and coated head to toe in mud. Ben led them into the only passenger seats available in the flight cabin, midway between Tanogo's snoop station and the weapons station at the aft bulkhead, and motioned them to sit. Zek obeyed gratefully, buckling himself in and donning a headset hanging on a hook behind his seat. Jaina took the headset hanging behind the other seat, but continued to stand and fire questions at Ben.
What are you doing here?
The skiff bucked as the weapons tech deployed chaff and decoys. Jaina's eyes went round, and before Ben could answer her first question, she demanded,
Are we under attack?
Ben nodded.
The Terrafonians sent some headhunters. Those lungworms!
She started to step past Ben toward the snoop station.
How many? Are they on a chase vector or an intercept?
Zek caught her arm. Jaina, you don't have rank here. He pulled her back to her seat. And we've just been rescued, remember? To Ben's surprise, Jaina did not jerk her arm away or tell Zek she wasn't asking or even flash him a dirty look. She simply sat down and reached for her crash webbing.
Sorry, she said. Guess I'm not used to being a civilian. I need to return to my station,
Ben said into his microphone.
Lieutenant Ioli will want to jump as soon as we're clear of the gravity well, and I'm the navigator.
Jaina nodded and waved Ben toward the cockpit.
Go. Let us know if we can help.
Ben started forward, shaking his head in amazement. Jaina was acting like she actually liked Zek. The skiff shook as the first concussion missiles fell prey to the countermeasures and began detonating. After strapping himself in, Ben activated the navicomputer display and brought up a schematic of the route they had taken to Terrafon.
Retrace our inbound jumps, Lieutenant?
Do we have a choice?
Ioli asked. Ben studied a maze of narrow, twisting hyperspace lanes that disappeared into the transitory mists with no indication of where they led.
We've got a gazillion choices, he said. There's just no way to tell where any of the others lead.
Ioli nodded.
That's what I thought, she said.
Ben plotted a bearing to their first jump and transferred it to Ioli's display, then set up a course retracing their route out of the transitory mists. By the time he finished, the rover had entered space and escaped Terrafon's gravity well. Ioli sounded the jump alarm, then a faint shudder ran through the skiff, and the stars stretched into lines.
I can handle it from here, Ben,
Ioli said. Ben removed his headset. The rover's engines had fallen silent the moment they left Terrafon's atmosphere, and collected Jaina and Zek, leading them through a bulkhead into the crew quarters. This cabin was as cramped as everything else aboard the little skiff, with a small galley and a sanisteam unit tucked into the two front corners and 4 bunks stacked behind a sleeping partition in back. Ben motioned Jaina and Zek to the small table in the center of the cabin.
You must be hungry, he said, turning to the galley. What do you want?
Jaina raised her brow, dislodging several flakes of mud, then looked down at her filthy jumpsuit and snorted.
"I'm glad to see Jason hasn't trained the teenage boy out of you completely," she chuckled. "Until I have a chance to clean up, a cup of caff will be fine."
"Then you can have the first Santa steam," Zek said, rising, "because I'm starved. I'll have anything, as long as it's hot and there's plenty of it." He stepped into the Santa steamer to clean his hands and face.
"Ben, what are you doing out here anyway?" Jaina asked. "Jason sent us."
"No kidding," Jaina deadpanned. "Why?"
"Because you disappeared after you went to Terrafon," Ben said. "And that Tennel Ka started to feel like she couldn't trust anyone. So she asked Jason to send us out to see what happened."
"Then at least we gave her some warning," Zek said, emerging from the Santa Steam unit. "Good."
"Warning about what?" Ben asked. "Terrafon's not exactly on Tennel Ka's side, is it?"
Jaina shook her head.
"The Ducha was already mustering her fleet when we arrived,"
she explained.
"And when we asked to see her, she tried to have us killed."
"She must have thought we were coming to arrest her," Zek added.
"And that's why you bombed her villa?" Ben asked.
Jaina frowned.
"We didn't bomb anything. Her Mytils did that." "The Ducha bombed her own villa?" Ben asked. "She really must have wanted you dead. It was the only way to protect the sister she has spying on Tennel Ka,"
Jaina said.
"She could strand us here by destroying our stealth X's. But now that Tennel Ka is the Queen Mother, I'm sure the Ducha has done enough research on Jedi abilities to realize we can touch each other through the Force across great distances."
"But that doesn't make any sense," Ben said. "Tennel Ka used to be a Jedi Knight, right?"
"A very good one," Jaina said.
"Then wouldn't she be able to tell when someone was lying to her? She'd know if Lady Galny was spying on her."
"Are you saying she doesn't?" Zek asked.
"Lady Galny was still with Tennel Ka when Jason sent me on this mission."
Jaina's expression grew alarmed.
"Then Tennel Ka doesn't know the Ducha is a traitor."
Ben shook his head.
"I don't think so," he said. "The last I heard, she was counting on the Galny fleet to bolster her defenses."
"Blast it!" Jaina pounded the table. "That's why the Ducha didn't want to talk to us. She's pretending to be on Tennel Ka's side, and she knew two Jedi would sense the lie."
"So Tennel Ka will think she's rushing to the defense, and then the Ducha can attack from inside." "That makes sense," Zek nodded, then frowned. "What I don't get is why Tennel Ka can't sense that her Chamberlain is a spy."
"Maybe Lady Galny can hide it when she's lying," Ben said.
"Or not know she's lying at all," Zek added.
Jaina turned to Zek and asked, "You think Lady Galny's not in on it?"
Zek shrugged. "You don't have to be a spy to be a security leak," he said. "Carelessness is all it takes."
"Yeah,"
Ben said, growing excited.
"Sort of like the blind Woolamander, only in reverse."
"The blind Woolamander?" Jaina asked.
"You know, when you use someone innocent to put out false intelligence,"
Ben explained.
"Only this way, you're collecting the information from someone innocent, and since she doesn't know what's happening, she's her own cutout, too. It's a perfect setup against someone like Tennel Ka."
Jaina looked vaguely worried.
"Where are you learning all this stuff?"
Ben winced inwardly. Weren't other apprentices learning anything Jason was teaching him?
"It's part of my GAG training."
Ben drew a veneer of calm over his Force presence so Jaina and Zek would not sense his lie.
"We need to know all that spy stuff."
"Well, you must be studying hard," Zek said, "because I think you're right." Jaina nodded.
"It makes sense. The real spy is probably one of Galny's consorts. Tennel Ka would have no reason to talk to them anyway."
She glanced back to Ben.
"And Hapen noblewomen have a bad habit of underestimating male duplicity."
Ben pointed to the locker beneath his bunk.
"My spare flight utilities might fit you, Jaina, but Zek..."
"Don't worry," Jaina said. "I'll stick Zex in the cleaner while he's Santa steaming."
"Then I better go talk to Lieutenant Ioli," Ben said. "She'll want to send a report to Jason as soon as we're out of the dead zone."
"Ask her to send one to Tennel Ka as well,"
Jaina requested. "I don't know if that's a good idea," Zek said. "We know she's surrounded by spies. even if Lady Galny isn't one of them.
We're just going to have to take that chance, Jaina said. Tenel Ka needs to know about this as soon. The Queen Mother will know about it as soon as Jason does,
Ben said.
She's aboard the Anakin Solo with him.
Jaina frowned.
The Anakin Solo? Jason named a GAG ship for Anakin? Yeah, he thought... What did he think?
Jaina demanded.
That he would drag our little brother's name into the Poodoo Pit with him? You'll have to ask him,
Ben said, realizing there was nothing he could say to calm Jaina down.
I gotta go.
Aboard the Millennium Falcon in the transitory mists.
Outside the Falcon's canopy hung a streaming veil of blue and white brilliance, so intense that it made Han's eyes hurt, like a fog blaster hangover. He hesitated at the back of the flight deck, trying to make some sense of what he was seeing, half convinced that it was the efflux tail of some Death Star-type megaship. But the longer Han studied the blazing sheet ahead, the more he realized he could not be looking at any kind of efflux tail. There were actually two bright streams, one broad and curving and fan-shaped, the other thin and straight and braided. He finally realized what he was seeing. Scowling toward the pilot's seat, which had become Leia's until his shoulder was healed enough to fly, Han stepped back onto the flight deck.
Are you flying my ship into a comet?
Yes, dear.
Leia met his gaze in the canopy reflection, then shot him a brief frown, one he knew was meant to remind him that they still had a lot to learn about Morwan and the usurpers.
We agreed to return Lady Morwan to her ducha, remember?
Of course I remember.
Han glanced at Morwan, who was in the co-pilot's chair, then dropped into the navigator's seat behind Leia.
But no one lives on a comet.
Actually, a surprising number of beings inhabit comets,
C-3PO offered from the communications station.
Hermits, pirates, fugitives, political exiles.
Al Grey's no hermit, Han grumbled. And even if she was, she must own a dozen empty moons already.
Actually, all of the Relifon moons are inhabited, Morwan said. But we're not meeting Ducha Al Grey at her residence.
Han glanced down at the navigation display and saw that they weren't anywhere near Relifon. Far from it, in fact.
The Hapen system?
He asked.
What are we doing here?
The answer to that is obvious, Morwan replied. And you shouldn't be out of medbay. You need that hydration drip to keep your electrolytes in balance. Blaster burns remove a lot of fluids from your system.
My fluids are just fine.
Han had the sinking feeling that he knew exactly why they were in the Hapen system, and he was fairly sure that Tenel Ka could not be ready. With so much of a Royal Navy assigned to the Galactic Alliance, she would need support from the nobles still loyal to her, support that would take time to arrive.
And stop changing the subject.
Fine, Morwan replied. Your health is no concern of mine. If you're truly having trouble figuring out the situation, just look through the viewport.
Han squinted out at the comet. Once his eyes had grown accustomed to the glow, he saw a dark crescent of empty space at the starboard edge of the canopy, just in front of the boiling brilliance of the comet's head. Clustered close behind the head were about 70 tiny black ovals, arranged in a three-dimensional diamond, commonly used to attack planetary defenses.
Oh, that,
Han said, trying to conceal the alarm he felt at how fast the usurpers were moving.
I mean, what are we doing here? You can't intend to be a part of this fight.
Morwan scowled over her shoulder at him.
You doubt my devotion?
That's not what I said,
Han raised his hands defensively.
But the Falcon ain't much of a warship.
I won't be aboard the Falcon after we rendezvous,
Morwan replied.
And I suspect you won't be either.
Is that a threat?
Han demanded.
Even if it were a threat, you're hardly in any condition to do anything about it, Morwan replied. But all I mean is I'll be aboard the Kendall, and you'll most likely be with your friends from Corellia.
Corellia?
Han glanced back toward the battle formation and realized that the three silhouettes in front were several times the size of the others.
I was wondering if those were our dreadnoughts.
As Han said this, he tried to catch Leia's gaze in the canopy reflection. but her eyes had that distant, unfocused look they got when she was caught up with something in the Force. With any luck, she was reaching out to Tenel Ka, trying to warn the Queen Mother about the trouble coming her way.
"Dreadnoughts?" Morwan repeated. "I really don't know what they are. Only the Corellia promised to send a fleet that could defeat Hape's defenses."
"They did," Han assured her. "Those dreadnoughts will punch through in no time. By this time tomorrow, Al Grey will be the new Queen Mother."
"That's not the reason she organized the overthrow," Morwan said. "Her only concern is for the consortium's independence."
"Whatever you say," Han said. "Doesn't matter to me."
He switched the navigator's display to tactical. None of the vessels in the usurper's fleet was broadcasting a transponder code, but the Falcon's threat computer had used a combination of mass and energy bleed-off patterns to classify the contacts as battle dragons. The three egg-shaped vessels at the head of the fleet, the Corellian dreadnoughts, it had designated unknown, assigning them an estimated threat level approximately twice that of the Imperial-class Star Destroyers. The dreadnoughts were surrounded by a screen of light frigates configured for fighter defense, and the battle dragons had a number of Nova battlecruisers interspersed among them. Han stored a screenshot of the tactical display, then noticed that one of the Nova cruisers had dropped out of formation and was turning to intercept them.
"Anyone in that fleet know we're coming?" he asked. "They're sending out a welcoming party."
"Duchess Algray won't be expecting me to arrive in..."
Morwan paused to glance around the flight deck.
"A common freighter," she finished.
"Then maybe we better turn this freighter around," Han said, bristling at the disdain in her voice. "Because they're not going to look in the windows before they open fire."
"That won't be necessary, Captain Solo," Morwan replied. "Open a ship-to-ship channel. I'm sure the Duchess will understand if I break comm silence to avoid being fired upon."
"Yeah, I suppose so," Han said. "Go ahead, 3PO.
C-3PO opened the channel. Morwan checked the comm status panel, no doubt to make sure the channel was on a tight beam, then activated her microphone.
"Heritage Fleet Nova, this is Lalu Morwan, a true guardian of Hapen independence, arriving aboard alternate transport..."
She glanced down to see what transponder code the Falcon was using.
"Longshot. Request clearance to join formation and rendezvous with the Kendall."
"Longshot acknowledged as our fellow guardian,"
came the cruiser's reply.
"Continue approach. Stand by for instructions."
Han studied Morwan with a raised brow.
"Don't say it," Morwan warned. "I've heard all the Lulu jokes I care to."
"Pardon me, but we're being hailed by the Kendall. Shall I put it on?"
"Of course,"
Morwan replied. C-3PO tapped a key, and a crisp, middle-aged voice came over the cockpit speakers.
"You're late."
"I apologize," Morwan replied. "It's Lalu, your fellow guardian."
"Yes, yes, we're both true guardians of Hapen independence,"
Algray said, clearly irritated at having to use the recognition phrase.
"Now tell me why you're late, and why you're arriving in that wreck."
"Actually, this is the Millennium Falcon," Morwan explained. "I was forced to turn my yacht over to our agent, and Princess Leia was kind enough to offer me a ride."
Algray paused before answering. Han stored another screenshot of his tactical display, this one detailing the Kendall's location and designating her the flagship.
"How did that come about?"
"It's a long story. Given our comm restrictions," Morwan replied carefully, "perhaps I could fill you in once I'm aboard."
"You won't be aboard,"
Algray replied.
"The Heritage Fleet is preparing to make the attack jump. Fall in at the back of the formation. You can explain after the battle."
"After? Ducha?"
"I'm afraid that Kendall has closed the channel. Shall I attempt to reestablish contact?"
"Absolutely not." Morwan turned to Leia. "Princess Leia, I truly hate to ask you this, but the Ducha's orders were clear."
"Of course, we'll obey."
Leia was already pushing the throttles forward.
"We're old hands at staying out of trouble in big battles like this."
As Leia spoke, the nav computer beeped to announce that it had received jump coordinates. A moment later, the usurper fleet, Han refused to think of it as the Heritage Fleet, began to accelerate under the head of the comet. While Leia chased after the fleet, Han performed the jump calculations, taking the time to look up Hape's rotation cycle so he could plot exactly where the fleet would revert to real space relative to the planet. After double-checking his answers, he copied the information to a data file, then attached the two screenshots he had captured identifying the fleet's flagship and composition. As field intelligence dossiers went, it was neither very thorough nor very timely, but it was the best he could do under the circumstances. The Falcon passed under the comet and pulled ahead. A moment later, the canopy blast tinting paled, revealing the blue circles of hundreds of ion engines spread across the darkness in front of them. The circles were accelerating toward the tiny white ball of the Hapen sun, but still growing rapidly larger as the Falcon overtook the fleet.
"Blast!" Han said.
He needed an excuse to make Leia delay a few seconds when the usurper fleet jumped into hyperspace, and he had to keep Morwan distracted at the same time.
"The sensor dish is sticking again. Lady Morwan, can you shut down the sensor suite just before we jump?"
"Won't that be dangerous when we revert?" she asked. "We won't be able to tell where the rest of the fleet is."
"Not if Leia waits a bit after everyone else jumps," Han replied. "And if you bring the sensors up again right after we jump, we won't be blind for more than 15 or 20 seconds.
20 seconds? 87% of all fleet maneuver accidents occur within the first 10 seconds of exiting hyperspace.
Better that than being blind for the rest of the battle," Leia said, following Han's lead. "I can handle it, 3PO. I have the Force, remember?"
"Of course. Pardon me for doubting you. It's impossible to assign a safety coefficient to the Force. But I'm quite sure we're as safe with you flying blind as we are even when Captain Solo has all his instruments."
Han would have reminded the droid that he had not gotten them killed yet, except that the blue circles ahead had begun to swell more slowly as Leia matched the fleet's velocity. He quickly formatted his intelligence dossier for transmission, then watched in silence as the Falcon slid into position at the rear of the formation. Finally, the voice of a female maneuvering chief came over the cockpit speakers.
"Jump in three."
Leia put her hand on the hyperdrive actuator, and Lady Morwan reached for the sensor controls.
"Two."
Han turned to C-3PO and held his finger to his lips, then cranked their S-thread unit to maximum transmission power and switched to a general hailing channel.
"Mark."
Space ahead flared blue as the usurper fleet accelerated to jump speed.
"Deactivate sensors," Leia ordered.
Morwan used both hands to pull the sensor suite glide switches to their off positions, and space went dark again as the usurper fleet entered hyperspace. Han hit the transmit key. Leia waited another second, then shoved the throttles to maximum and activated the hyperdrive. The stars stretched into a pearlescent blur. Han returned the comm unit to its previous settings, then caught C-3PO looking at him with a cocked head.
"It was hardly necessary to do that yourself. I'm perfectly capable of..."
"Your timing is no good," Han interrupted. "And that's the last I want to hear about it."
"But my timing is excellent. My reaction speed is less than 2/1000ths of a second, which is 2 magnitudes better than yours."
The reversion alarm chimed, and an instant later, the gray veil of hyperspace erupted into a wall of crimson energy. The cockpit speakers began to crackle with alarmed voices and shipboard explosions. Then the invisible fist of a turbo laser strike glanced off the Falcon's top shields, pounding her so hard that C-3PO clanged to the deck on his back.
"We've been hit! Shall I activate the abandoned ship siren?"
"No," Han said. "That was just a graze. We're fine."
He peered over Leia's shoulder at the damage control board and saw that he was only partially right. The forward cargo hold had sealed itself off because of a pressure leak, and a coolant line had burst somewhere in the aft engineering tunnel. But Han thought they would probably last out the battle, as long as they didn't take another big hit.
"Let's not do that again," he said, speaking into Leia's ear. "We don't want to scare the droid."
A turbo laser strike blossomed 100 meters beneath the Falcon's belly, bucking Han against his crash webbing and setting off a new round of alarms. C-3PO emitted a surprised squeal and wrapped his arms around the comm officer's chair. Then Leia flipped them into a tight spiral, and even Han gasped in alarm. He ached to take the pilot's yoke, but with only one hand to hold it, that would have been foolish even for him. The crimson fury of a rolling barrage erupted ahead and began to advance toward the Falcon.
Dive!
Han was straining against his crash webbing, yelling over Leia's shoulder.
Go below!
Leia had pushed the yoke as far forward as it would go.
Trying!
The barrage passed over their stern, bucking the ship hard enough to bang C-3PO against the floor and to send a bolt of pain shooting through Han's wounded shoulder. A glowing red disc appeared ahead, then quickly expanded into a sheet of half-molten metal that had once been the upper saucer of a Hapen battle dragon. Escape pods were spraying from the vessel like shooting stars, and momentary fists of flame kept punching out through the breaches in the hull.
Pull up!
Han cried. Leia was already bringing their nose up, and the battle dragon began to swing out from beneath the Falcon.
Trying!
They leveled off just above the battle dragon, so close to the half-melted hull that the temperature inside the Falcon began to climb. They emerged into a pocket of relative calm behind two wrecked battle dragons. The main part of the fleet was barely visible ahead, a field of blue efflux circles exchanging dashes of color with an enemy fleet too distant to spot visually. Han let out a sigh of relief.
You see? Nothing to worry about.
Nothing to worry about?
Morwan released her chair arms and turned to Han with half-accusatory glare.
We were ambushed! The Royal Navy was waiting for us!
Han met her gaze with his best Sabacc face.
Yeah, it's almost like they knew the reversion coordinates. Wonder how that happened.
Morwan's eyes narrowed.
So do I, Captain Solo.
They passed the wrecked battle dragons, and the Falcon's canopy darkened against fresh blossoms of nearby turbolaser strikes. The Hapen Royal Navy was pouring fire into the Kendall.
Looks like you lucked out staying with us,
Han said, removing his hand from the filter glides.
Algray's flagship is taking quite a pounding.
Yes.
Morwan caught Han's arm and held him in front of her.
I think we both know why that is.
Something small jabbed Han in the side, and he looked down to find a small holdout blaster pressed to his ribs.
You think I had something to do with it?
The anger in Han's voice was genuine, and mostly with himself, for letting Morwan get the drop on him.
Of all the ungrateful Shi-Huts!
Save it, Solo, Morwan ordered. You really don't want to heat my jets more than you have. I'm already furious with myself for not seeing through you two from the start.
Seeing through us how? Leia asked.
The Falcon decelerated and banked as she turned away from the battle.
And you really don't want to see Leia lose her temper, Han said.
As soon as Leia had said shoot, C-3PO had started to creep toward the back of the flight deck, probably intending to sneak down the access corridor to fetch Cockmame and Meowal.
Ever since she became a Jedi, when she gets mad, things just start flying at you from all directions.
That shouldn't be a problem, Captain Solo. Your fate rests entirely in the princess's hands. I won't blast you if she turns back toward the battle.
Leia continued to bank away.
What for?
Because she doesn't want it to look suspicious when we send Tenel Ka another message,
Han said, glancing down at the tactical display.
She wants to tell Tenel Ka to tighten up and hold her position.
Leia was quiet for a moment, probably studying her own display. After a moment, Leia asked Han,
You think the dreadnoughts can actually break through?
Han nodded.
That's what they were designed for, to penetrate an enemy fleet and tear it apart from the inside. And if that strategy works...
They'll go after Tenel Ka,
Leia finished.
And it won't matter whether they win the ship-to-ship melee that follows. If they kill Tenel Ka, the monarchy will be shattered. And the Heritage Council will still be in a position to put the consortium back together again,
Morwan said.
Very astute, Princess.
C-3PO reached the back of the flight deck and began to clank down the access corridor. Morwan didn't even turn to look.
It sounds as though we're running out of time, Princess. Turn back now or I pull the trigger.
Leia sighed, and the Falcon's nose started to drift back toward the battle.
Leia!
Han's fear had turned to embarrassment. Could she really believe he would want her to risk Tenel Ka's life to save him?
The traitors have a spy!
It's okay, Han, Leia said. I have a feeling it won't matter.
Of course it'll matter,
Han objected.
They'll know what ship Tenel Ka is!
That's enough, Captain Solo. Morwan jammed the blaster harder into his ribs. With the Jedi and two Nogri aboard, I don't expect to survive this anyway. On my way out, I won't hesitate to rid the galaxy of one more Alliance brain tick.
Alliance brain tick?
Han pushed his wounded arm forward in the sling.
There's no call for insults.
He clamped his hand over Morwan's holdout blaster. As he pushed the tiny weapon away from his body, she squeezed the trigger, sending a flurry of bolts burning across his palm and ricocheting off the control board.
Han, no!
Leia screamed. But Han was already slamming the elbow of his good arm into Morwan's nose. He felt cartilage crumble and heard her scream, but the blaster bolts continued to come. He brought his elbow back again. Morwan released the holdout blaster and reached up to protect her nose. Han stepped away, moving the weapon to his good hand, and letting out a roar of pain as he finally realized just how much his scorched palm hurt.
Han!
Leia reached out gently and pushed Han back so the lightsaber in her hand would have a clear path to Morwan's head.
What are you doing?
Taking my ship back.
Han pointed the weapon at Morwan.
What do you think?
I think you're getting yourself shot up again for no reason.
Leia laid her lightsaber in her lap, then ordered, sit down and keep her covered until the Nogri get here. Han dropped into the navigator's seat.
What do you mean, no reason?
A cloud of gray smoke was hanging over the control board, rising from half a dozen holes that Morwan had shot through the Durasteel.
She was gonna kill me.
I don't think so, Leia said. She wouldn't have had any reason.
Han noticed they were still headed toward the battle.
Don't tell me you were gonna send that message.
Actually, I still am.
Leia said. Leia nodded at the tactical display, which showed Tenel Ka's formation starting to fall back in preparation for a ship-to-ship free-for-all.
Open a channel.
Han studied his display, trying to see what Leia was talking about. Unfortunately, he was distracted by an irregular pattern of flickering and blinking.
Blasted woman,
he said.
She hit something in the control panel.
Which is all the more reason to send the message now, Han,
Leia said.
Tenel Ka can't let the battle degenerate into a ship melee, or the Alliance won't be able to spring its trap.
Trap? I don't see a trap.
Leia fell silent for a time, then said,
listen, Han, if you can't do this, just say so.
Now Han was growing really confused.
Do what?
Once you send the message, we both know our names will be Hutt Slime and Corellia,
Leia said.
Gedgen will know we were working against them here, and you'll be branded a traitor.
Leia's words hit Han hard, up near the heart, and he realized she was right. If they helped Tenel Ka now, it could only be in the open, and the Corellian High Command, Wedge, Gedgen, all of them, would know he had chosen Hapes over his homeworld. But how could Han not choose Tenel Ka? Corellia was in the wrong here, trying to assassinate a sovereign leader and expand the war just to win a more favorable negotiating position. Trying to plunge 63 worlds into a civil war that would make the Corellian conflict with the Alliance look like a spitball fight.
Leia, my reputation doesn't matter, he said. My conscience does.
Han switched the comm unit to the hailing channel, which he would need to use since they didn't have the codes or frequencies for Tenel Ka's fleet. He looked over at Leia and blew her a kiss, then activated his microphone and began to broadcast on the general hailing channel.
This is a message for Queen Mother Tenel Ka from Han Solo. Listen up, kid. I've got something important to tell you.
Depot Cantina near Roku.
Outside the viewport of the Depot Cantina hung a glorious aurora, a luminous explosion of green and violet and scarlet fanning across the face of the transitory mist from the direction of the star Roku. The spectacle was a testament to the vast sweep of the mists and the ferocious power of a blue giant solar wind. But today, Mara found it more eerie than awe-inspiring. Today, its dancing beauty was only the barrier that prevented her and Luke from making calm contact with their son. Mara turned away from the viewport and looked across the table, where Luke sat nursing his third hot chocolate of the afternoon.
We might as well face it. Ben's not coming. Either Jason didn't send the rendezvous message or Ben didn't get it. But something went wrong.
Luke nodded and took another sip from his mug.
And something wrong is coming, he added. Don't you feel it? Now that Luke mentioned it, Mara could feel something.
It wasn't much. Just a faint prickle, easily mistaken for a chill. But it was there. Mara turned back to the viewport, but this time she studied the reflections in its corners instead of the aurora outside. Most of the customers she could see in the murky cantina were good-looking humans, typical Hapens, and without exception, they seemed more interested in their meals or the Feline Glimmick singer on stage than in the Skywalkers. The non-humans, a dozen blue-skinned Duros, some anvil-headed Arcona, and a couple of Mon Calamari, seemed transfixed by the aurora beyond the viewport. And the Twillick family who ran the place was being kept far too busy to pay attention to anyone not ordering something. Mara looked back to Luke.
You think Jason set us up?
I do. Luke's voice was steady, but their force bond was permeated by sadness and by a sense of bewilderment and failure. If Tenel Ka hadn't verified it, I wouldn't even believe he had sent Ben to find Jaina and Zek. Mara sighed.
I have to admit, I'm beginning to feel a bit like a fool for placing my faith in Jason.
Don't, Luke said.
We both trusted him, and I'm still not sure we were wrong. Jason helped Ben overcome his fear of the Force. We can't forget that.
How could I?
Mara asked. But if he has set us up, if he's leading Ben into the dark side...
Now who's leaping to conclusions? Luke leaned across the table and took her hands. In a low voice, he added, Look, even if Jason is working with Umaya, I don't think it's been for long. And it doesn't mean he's becoming a Sith.
It doesn't mean he isn't, Mara countered. We can't know what's going on between him and Umaya.
I know Jason, Luke said quickly. Whatever he's doing, it's because he thinks it's right for the galaxy. Once he realizes he's mistaken, he'll be easy to bring back.
Mara considered this, trying to recall when she had ever seen Jason do anything selfish, trying to think of anything, even after assuming command of GAG, that Jason had done out of self-interest rather than for the good of the state. After a few moments, she nodded. Her fear for Ben and her anger at feeling deceived by Jason were beginning to affect her judgment.
You're right, she said. But we'd better work fast. Jason is too powerful already. And if Lumaya has her hooks in him, it won't be long before he reaches the point of no return. We can't let that happen, Luke. We can't let him drag the galaxy down with him.
Mara rose and hiked up her equipment belt, which tended to slip down on her hips now that she was carrying the extra weight of the Shoto she had built in anticipation of meeting Lumaya.
Let's catch up with the Anakin and stick close to Jason. Ben will show up there sooner or later.
If he hasn't already. Luke rose and started toward the door, and suddenly, the uneasy prickle he had been feeling blossomed into full-blown danger sense. He glanced around the room, trying to locate the source of the threat. He felt nothing menacing from the other patrons, but that didn't stop him from pulling his lightsaber off his belt as casually as possible. Mara already had her weapon in her hand, though. Like Luke, she held it down at her side to avoid sparking a panic.
You feel it too?
Let's go, Luke said. He weaved through the crowd toward the nearest exit hatch, and Mara stayed close on his heels. They were a few paces from the exit when a hunched figure appeared in the bare Durasteel corridor outside the cantina, hobbling out of an intersection about 6 meters up the way. She was wearing a bulky black cloak with the hood pulled up, and she was being careful to keep her face turned away from the ceiling lights. Luke had just enough time to realize that he did not feel her presence in the Force before she brought her arm forward and sent a silver tube tumbling down the gray corridor toward him. A set of flashing diodes midway down its length confirmed the cylinder's nature. He raised his arm and used the Force to hurl the tube back up the corridor. Grenade! He yelled. Luke hit the floor amid a torrent of spilling drinks and flailing customers. His eardrums popped painfully as the air pressure dropped, and the exit hatch fell with a deafening clang. A hull breach alarm began to whistle overhead. Luke reached out in the Force and sensed Mara lying about 3 meters away, surprised but unharmed and already recovering her wits. He sprang to his feet
and saw that the area closest to the exit had taken the brunt of the explosion, with perhaps 24 beings lying on the debris-strewn floor in various states of injury. Mara stepped to Luke's side. Nice save.
That was just the opening salvo, Luke said. There's a reason she attacked before we were...
A long, hissing crackle sounded from the second exit, drawing a frenzy of screams from fleeing patrons. Luke had not heard the sizzle of a striking light whip in decades, and the sound sent a hot prickle up his spine. He reached inside his robe and withdrew the Shoto, a half-length lightsaber he had been carrying in anticipation of just this moment.
Well, I'd say this proves it. Luke's heart ached with disappointment. Ben's not here. Lumaya is.
Yeah. Mara's voice was angry. Jason set us up.
She snapped the Shoto off her own equipment belt and started for the cantina's inner wall, moving into position to flank their attacker. Luke started toward the hatch and saw snakes of light crackling into the crowd ahead. A leathery anvil-shaped head went flying, and 2 human arms dropped to the floor. 12 voices cried out in pain as ribbons of bloody cloth flew from their tunics.
Back, you creatures!
The icy voice belonged to Lumaya.
Get back! Only one man can save you now.
The whip struck again, and the confused patrons began to fall back. A dark cloaked figure appeared in the hatchway. Her hood had been pushed back off her head, but her face was swaddled in black cloth. Her light whip trailed at her side.
You!
Lumaya pointed a long finger in Luke's direction.
Lay down your blades and kneel.
Not a chance. Luke ignited his blades, one short and one long, to counter the dual nature of her weapon, and watched the crowd part before him. Lumaya's light whip crackled out again and shredded Aduros down one whole flank.
The Jedi has decided your fate,
Lumaya yelled over the screeching Duros. Her whip lashed out again, this time wrapping its tendrils around the waist of a lithe Hapen beauty and cutting her nearly in half.
Because of him, you all die.
Cantina patrons began to whirl on Luke, many pulling blasters or vibroblades. Their eyes were distant and their mouths uniformly twisted into the same angry snarl. And Luke realized that Lumaya was using the Force to redirect their fear and anger toward him. Luke danced forward, shoving patrons out of his way with the Force and using his light blades to return the bolts of those who made the mistake of firing on him. Lumaya flicked her whip at Luke's legs, forcing him into a high somersault that bought her half a second to spin away. He came down a couple of paces inside the cantina, framed in the hatchway and facing the murky corridor where Alima crouched, hidden inside her Force shadow. Then Lumaya's light whip crackled in at Luke's flank, striking high, low, and in between all at once. He pivoted around to defend himself, filling the air with sparks and ozone and flying shards of kyber crystal, as he blocked with a short blade and used the long to cut away one of the strands. Alima could have taken him at that moment. She had the cone dart in the blowgun, and the blowgun pressed to her lips, and Skywalker was so focused on Lumaya that he would never have sensed the dart coming. That was what Lumaya would want, what she expected. But where was the balance in that? Luke Skywalker had taken so much from her. The use of her arm, her nest, her identity. And it would not be right for Alima to simply kill him. She had to destroy him, to let him watch Mara die first, so that when he died, he would know there was no hope. So he would know that Lumaya had won, that the Sith would have his nephew and his son, and that the Jedi Order would die with him. So Alima held her dart, waiting motionless, while Lumaya's light whip flashed again and again, keeping Skywalker framed in the hatchway for her, striking at his flanks and head to keep him from pivoting or somersaulting or simply advancing out of her line of sight. Finally, Skywalker feigned a leap for the hatchway. When Lumaya made the mistake of trying only half-heartedly to block his escape, he made an unbelievable parry across his body with his short blade, then spun into a slashing, whirling advance with his long blade. Lumaya had no choice except to retreat. Skywalker vanished from the hatchway and out of Alima's sight. Then the last of the light whip's metallic strands whirled past the hatchway.
A fresh chorus of screams arose, and a jet of blood arced out of the cantina to splat down in a line of elongated red beads. When Alima looked back into the cantina, it was to find Mara crouching opposite her, just inside the hatchway and facing away. Now was Alima's chance. But it would not be enough to simply kill Mara. Alima was a Jedi, and Jedi served the balance. As she filled her lungs, Alima was also reaching out to Skywalker, sharing with him all the sorrow and loneliness and despair he had caused her, the shame and hopelessness and unending anguish. A bolt of surprise shot through the Force. Skywalker's eyes widened and slid toward the hatchway. And that was all the opening Lumaya needed. The light whip cracked again, wrapping Skywalker in a fiery cage of light and leather. The short blade went flying, taking along the hand that had been holding it. And Skywalker's robe fell away below the armpits in ribbons, leaving the air pink and smoky with blood and charred flesh. Alima emptied her lungs, and the dart shot from the blowgun. Mara heard Luke screaming and thought it was only because he had been so badly hurt. But then he touched her through their Force bond, and she realized he was frightened for her, that something was coming at her only slightly under the velocity of a blaster bolt. She dived away and felt her skin prickle as something tiny and dark shot past her shoulder. A female Twi'lek cried out in astonishment, and when Mara rolled back to her feet, it was to find one of the cantina owner's wives standing a couple of meters in front of her, staring back through the hatchway as she plucked a tiny cone-shaped dart from her thigh. Clearly, Lumaya had brought backup. But Mara had no time to think of likely candidates. The Twi'lek suddenly began to tremble and gasp for breath. Then her leg buckled, and she collapsed in convulsions. Poison. Mara whirled around to charge through the hatchway, only to find it blocked by a swarm of terrified Haepans trying to flee. She deactivated her weapons and rushed into their midst, force-shoving the leaders into the dark corridor ahead of her. Luke was badly wounded, and she knew it. But she was not going to save him by giving the dart blower another shot. As soon as she was through the hatchway, she reignited her blades and spun toward the dark corner from which the dart had come. There was nothing but shadow. Fleeing patrons continued to jostle past Mara, cursing her for blocking their escape. Thinking the attacker had already fled up the corridor, she turned to follow, then wondered why the corner had still been in shadow with the glow of two light blades shining into it. Mara pivoted around to face the corner, but had to deactivate her lightsaber when a salt-drunk Arcona nearly impaled himself on her blade, whistling in panic and slamming into her so hard she had to use the Force to avoid being bowled over. "Get off!" she ordered. Instead of force-shoving the Arcona back through the hallway, she stepped back to let him continue up the corridor. And that was what saved her life, when a deep blue, almost black lightsaber blade came shooting out of his chest. So close to her throat, she was afraid to drop her chin. Reacting even before she understood what was happening, Mara whipped her left hand around behind the shrieking Arcona and felt her Shoto's blade rub across something. A female voice cried out in surprise, and the dark blade vanished from the Arcona's chest, and he dropped to the floor, gurgling and wailing. Standing behind him was a twisted figure in a black Jedi robe. She held herself slightly hunched, as though it would pain her to stand upright, and one arm hung atrophied and limp beneath a sagging shoulder. The far leku had been seared off just above the shoulder, while the near one had a smoking wound across the back, where it had been grazed by Mara's blade. Alima? Mara was not so astonished that she forgot to defend herself when the Twi'lek reignited her lightsaber. She caught Alima's attack on her Shoto, then swept the Twi'lek's blade aside and brought her long lightsaber around in a killing slash. Alima used the Force to hurl herself into a backward somersault, crashing upside down through the line of still fleeing cantina customers. She alit on both feet on the other side of the corridor. There were a dozen questions Mara would have liked to ask Alima. Was she Lumaya's apprentice? How had she escaped Tanupe? How long had she been back? But Mara could feel through her Force bond that Luke was fading fast. His energy was dwindling, and his concentration slipping, and he was drawing heavily on the Force just to keep his pain in check and his body moving. Mara stepped into the middle of the corridor, bringing herself within striking range of Alima. Mara leveled her long blade at the Twi'lek's throat. "I don't have much time, so I'll give you one chance to surrender. After that,
This is to the death.
Alima glanced toward the cantina, where the crackle of Lumaya's light whip was growing both louder and more frequent, and the sneer that came to her lips was surprisingly confident.
You could let us limp away, she said. We promised to go.
Mara grew cold and angry inside. That was your chance. She leapt in, attacking with both hands, beating Alima's defense down with her lightsaber and thrusting for the torso with her shoto. Alima dropped her lightsaber and stretched out her arm, driving her sharp Twi'lek finger talons into Mara's throat and twisting aside so that the short lightsaber slipped past without hitting anything. Mara's breath stopped instantly, and she felt herself choking on something wet and warm. She started to bring her arms together, intending to cross her blades through Alima's body, then realized they had dropped to her sides. She started to bring them up, but Alima's eyes had grown dark, and tiny forks of energy were crackling across her blue face. Mara did not have the half a second it would take to raise her arms again, so she simply threw herself backward, pulling her throat off the talons and bringing her legs up to either side of Alima's. A bolt of blue lightning crackled past above her face, so close she saw it even through closed eyes. Mara was already scissoring her feet, catching the Twi'lek below the knees with one leg and above the knees with the other. The two foes hit the floor in the same instant, Alima coming down hard on the back of her head. The Twi'lek went instantly limp, her arms and body flopping to the floor as though her robe were filled with warm gel meat. Mara sat up, already bringing her lightsaber around to lop off Alima's head, then stopped the blade just centimeters above the Twi'lek's throat. She could not kill an unconscious foe, even one who had betrayed the Jedi Order, even when she was in a hurry to help Luke. Having knocked out enough beings to be certain Alima was not faking her unconsciousness, Mara put away her weapons and spun to her knees. She could sense that Luke's strength was continuing to fade and that he was starting to doubt his ability to prevail. But leaving the Twi'lek armed and free, even when she was unconscious, was not an option. As the exodus of patrons resumed through the hatchway, Mara bound Alima's hands behind her back and collected her lightsaber and blowgun from where they had been dropped. Then she opened the Twi'lek's robe to check for concealed weapons and was suddenly very glad she had stopped short of killing an unconscious enemy. Under the robe, Alima wore a black combat vest with a sensor pad blinking over the heart. A bundle of thin wires ran from the pad down into a chest pocket, bulging with something shaped like a thick wafer. Very carefully, Mara opened the pocket and followed the wires to what she had feared she would find. A dead man relay, connected to the proton detonator from a Baradium missile. There was no question of returning to the cantina without disconnecting the relay. Head injuries were too unpredictable. The Twi'lek could die at any moment, and even if she lived, one of the fleeing patrons might trigger the device accidentally. Unfortunately, the wires had to be disconnected in a specific sequence to keep from triggering the detonator. Mara only hoped that Luke could hold Lumaya off until she finished. Even with the Force to guide her, this was going to take time. And time was something Luke did not have. He could feel that in the fire eating his lungs, in the raw nettling of his flesh. His breath came in inadequate gasps, and his blood was bubbling from his side in a pink froth. He was calling on the Force to keep fighting, drawing it through himself faster than his body could endure, literally boiling his own cells. At most, he had another minute of fight in him. Maybe less. Luke had to end this now. He blocked a pair of crackling energy strands with his lightsaber and flung them aside, then launched himself across a clackball table toward Lumaya. She countered by pivoting away, bringing between them a Twi'lek serving girl. He could have continued the attack, slicing through the chests of both shield and captor, but even desperate, he could not kill a hostage. He threw himself into an aerial cartwheel and came down on a slick, utensil-strewn floor squarely facing Lumaya. Her hand flicked, and the light whip came arcing toward his head. Luke dropped to his haunches and let it crackle past overhead. Then, when Lumaya started to back away from the expected lunge at her midsection, he hit her hard with a force shove and spun her half around. She crashed into a drink table and nearly fell, but quickly brought her hostage around to protect her from an attack. Luke smiled and raised his arm, pointing his lightsaber toward the serving girl. Then, using the Force to wrench her free of Lumaya's grasp, he sent her flying across the clackball table.
She crashed down on the other side in a heap, screaming in terror, but far safer than she had been a moment earlier. By then, Lumaya had recovered from her stumble, and the light whip was snaking back toward Luke. He sprang into a roundoff, wrapping the tip of his blade into the crackling strands as he passed over upside down. He landed on the clackball table's squishy surface and jerked backward with all his might. And that was when his mangled body failed him. Instead of yanking the weapon from Lumaya's hand, his lightsaber slipped out of his own grasp and went flying into the shadows. Luke cursed in disbelief, then rolled off the table in a backward somersault. Even that turned into a disaster. He landed on the body of one of Lumaya's original victims, and too weak to steady himself, hit the floor with an audible thump. Lumaya must have suspected a trap, because when Luke failed to rise immediately, she did not rush to attack. Instead, she called.
It's not too late, Skywalker. Let me kill you now, and everyone else survives. Even Mara.
Very generous. As Luke replied, he was inspecting the cantina floor, searching for the Shoto he had lost when Lumaya took his cybernetic hand.
But I don't think so. You can't have Jason.
Jason?
Lumaya let out a cold laugh.
What makes you think this is about him?
Your involvement with GAG. Who else could give you an apartment? Who else could give you access to their files?
Again, that cruel laugh.
Indeed.
The light whip's crackling grew deeper as Lumaya shortened the strands for easier control.
Who else has access to Jason's codes? Who else could give orders to GAG officers in Jason's name?
The questions caught Luke like a kick in the stomach. He knew that Lumaya was only trying to hurt him, that her implications were likely more false than true. But the possibility explained too much. And now that he thought back on Ben's behavior over the last several months, he had to admit that he had seen too much of that possibility himself. Something crunched on the floor as Lumaya circled the base of the clackball table. Luke gave up his search for his Shoto and began to look for another weapon. He had not brought his own lightsaber into the cantina, preferring light blades instead. But the body he had fallen on was almost certainly a spacer, and spacers always carried blasters.
You're lying!
Luke found the spacer's belt and followed it to a holster.
Just saying that to hurt me!
Does that make it a lie?
Lumaya asked.
You've caused me a lot of pain over the years, Skywalker. What better way to repay it than bringing your family legacy full circle?
Luke knew she was only trying to twist the vibroblade, to hurt him as much as she could before she killed him. But he stuck up his head anyway.
Stop it!
He yelled with real anger.
You'll never make a Sith of my...
Luke never had a chance to say son. All he saw was the bright glow of Lumaya's light whip snaking across the clackball table, barely centimeters above the surface. And he knew that his reflexes were just too slow right now, that he could not duck quickly enough to keep the whip from slicing into his brain. So Luke simply fell backward, closing his eyes against the crackling glow as the strand swept past a finger's width above his nose, bringing up the blaster he had taken from the dead spacer's holster, allowing the force to guide his hand, squeezing the trigger three times before he felt Lumaya's shock and the force, then squeezing it twice more before he heard her body hit the floor. And suddenly, Mara was screaming at him from across the cantina, flooding the force with alarm.
Stop firing! You can't kill her!
Luke looked back to Lumaya and thought he had done a pretty good job of it. She was lying at the foot of the clackball table with three different columns of blaster smoke rising from her chest, her cybernetic life support girdle sparking and sizzling with short circuits. Her light whip lay on the floor nearby, where she had dropped it when he blasted her. His own lightsaber lay a few meters beyond, where it had landed when she used the whip to disarm him. Luke used the force to summon both weapons to him, then stood and went to check on her. To his surprise, Lumaya's eyes were focused and alert, and horribly bugged out with pain. As soon as she saw him, it crinkled at the corners, as though she were smiling. That tiny act made his spine ache with danger sense, but he tried not to let that show when he spoke.
Mara's coming!
he gasped. She'll try to save you. Maybe not. Mara came up behind him and took one look at Lumaya, then said, In fact, not a chance. She grabbed Luke and tried to pull him away, but still fighting his pain, he pulled back and remained where he was. Mara, we can't leave her. Yes, Luke, we can. Mara leaned down and pulled open Lumaya's robe, revealing, aside from blaster wounds and life support girdle, a black combat vest with a sensor pad over the heart. The diodes were blinking weakly and erratically. In fact, I think we better run.
Aboard the Millennium Falcon, near Migos, a moon in orbit around planet Hapes.
With a swarm of pincer-winged Mytils nibbling at the forward shields and a Nova-class battlecruiser chewing on the stern, Leia was jerking the pilot's yoke around at random, just trusting to the Force and blind luck to get the Falcon through the storm of enemy fire. Golden shimmers of dispersal energy began to appear a few meters ahead, a sign that the Falcon's shields were overloading. Leia ignored the flashing maelstrom long enough to glance at the co-pilot's seat, where Han sat hunched over a disassembled shield adjustment panel. C-3PO stood next to him, trying to hold the panel steady against the control board while Han worked. How are those shield repairs coming?
Even I can't splice a moving target, Han complained. Hold still, 3PO!
It's not my fault. Holding still is quite impossible while Princess Leia continues to evade enemy fire. The Falcon's inertial compensators are simply inadequate for this kind of maneuvering.
Leia swung wide to avoid a flight of concussion missiles. The Falcon shuddered as the Nogri operating the cannon turrets cut loose with the quad cannons. The Mytil that had launched the attack erupted into a boiling sphere of flame.
Perhaps we wouldn't need to evade so wildly if Princess Leia were to travel in a direction opposite the enemy.
I can't, 3PO, Leia said. At the moment, she was flying away from the usurpers at a right angle, doing her best to keep the Falcon pointed toward the growing yellow crescent of Hape's third moon, Migos. We'll get caught in the crossfire.
Crossfire? Between whom? I didn't see a friendly fleet exit hyperspace behind us.
It will be here, Leia said.
Sure, any day now, Han added.
A turbo laser strike erupted close to port, throwing the Falcon sideways and slamming C-3PO into the back of Leia's seat. The droid bounced off and crashed to the deck, leaving a tangle of broken wires sparking in an empty control board socket.
Oh dear, I seem to have pulled the shield adjustment panel away from the control board. Now it's going to take Captain Solo twice as long to make repairs. Oh, the pain of it.
Forget it, 3PO.
The fusing pen gave a soft snap as Han deactivated it.
We never had a chance.
Leia put one hand on the throttles.
Do you see any reason I shouldn't push the engines hard?
You mean aside from the leaking coolant line and the number 4 vector plate getting sticky?
Yeah.
Leia almost took her hand off the throttles. She hadn't noticed the sticky vector plate.
I mean aside from those two problems.
Well then no, I don't.
Han sounded a little more hopeful, as though taking a desperate gamble with their lives on the line was all he ever needed to cheer him up.
Let her rip, sweetheart.
Leia pointed the Falcon's nose straight toward the dark interior of the crescent moon, then pushed the throttles past the overload stops and kept pushing until they would go no farther. She felt herself sink in her seat as the vessel's acceleration tested the already overburdened inertial compensators, and they shot forward into the swarm of Mytils that had been harassing them. As the Falcon careened through their midst, the starfighters took close-range snapshots, and space exploded into a wall of energy blossoms. The Nogri answered with the quad cannons, taking out 4 starfighters in half as many seconds. Then the Falcon was through the formation, with nothing but the crater-pocked sickle of Migos swelling rapidly in the forward canopy. The Mytils launched a desperate volley of concussion missiles and turned to give chase, placing themselves between the Falcon and the Nova Cruiser. Exactly as Leia had hoped they would. Han activated the decoy launchers, and the Nogri kept the quad cannons chugging, and the missiles started to vanish from the tactical display, 2 and 3 at a time. Fearful of hitting her own starfighters, the Nova quieted her turbo lasers, and there was a moment of relative peace as the Mytils struggled to bring themselves back into cannon range and reacquire target locks. Leia kept their nose pointed straight ahead, adding gravitational pull to the ship's acceleration. And the gap between the Falcon and Migos began to close more quickly than the one between the Falcon and the Mytils.
Trying the old solo slingshot?
Han asked. A partial, anyway, Leia said. Seems like a good time to learn it.
Sure, why not?
Han replied.
You do know that it's a pretty tricky maneuver at full acceleration, right?
Leia nodded.
I thought it might be.
And if that vector plate sticks at the wrong time, you know the crater we drill is going to be about 3 kilometers deep.
I hadn't actually done the calculations, Leia admitted.
A cold prickle ran down Leia's spine. She glanced at the tactical display and saw that the Mytils were swinging hard to port, trying to open a clear firing lane for the Nova. She swung the yoke in the same direction, trying to keep the starfighters behind them and banking toward the center of the moon, in the wrong direction for the slingshot maneuver.
Honey?
Han's voice was nervous and high.
That's...
A boiling cloud of brilliance erupted to starboard, engulfing the position they had just abandoned.
A nice save, Han admitted. Probably would have done the same thing myself.
They started to climb when space ahead broke into crooked snakes of iridescence. The proximity alarm blared to life, and the viewport was suddenly packed with blue halos, all growing steadily larger.
What the blazes? Leia gasped.
I think your fleet showed up, Han said. And in the wrong place.